And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean Haglund, actress Darlene Flugel, who I was very familiar with when I was a kid, first really falling in love with movies. She died after a lengthy battle with Alzheimer's. She was 64. She was diagnosed with the disease at 56 years of age.
Wow.
She began modeling as a teenager as a way to earn money following the death of her father when she was 16. At 18, she went to New York City and signed with the legendary modeling agent, Eileen Ford. But she was serious about her ambition to become an actor, and so she studied with none other than Stella Adler.
Wow.
Though her first role, probably not coincidentally, was playing a model in the 1978 film Eyes of Laura Mars.
Oh, of course.
She then...
Faye Dunaway.
And this is also why I dug her when I was young, because this I had a real soft spot for this particular film. She followed it up with Roger Corman's low-budget Star Wars riff, Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yeah, right.
Do you remember that? Which was... John Saxon was in that, for crying out loud. That was kind of Magnificent Seven in space.
Yes. Barely. I think I started watching it again recently on one of my Roku channels and did not get all the way through it, shall we say.
She shared screen time with Robert De Niro in Once Upon a Time in America, Kirk Douglas in Tough Guys, Billy Crystal in Running Scared, and she had a very memorable part as the informant in the 1985 thriller To Live and Die in L.A. I mean, those are some major movies there.
Yeah, for sure.
On television, she appeared in the pilot episode of MacGyver. She played the wife of Dennis Farina in the first season of Crime Story, which was really a very underrated Michael Mann series. Around the time of Miami Vice. And it was really ahead of its time. I mean, it was telling the kind of season-long serialized stories that nowadays would make it championed, right?
Right. Yeah.
But back then that was a no-no. Yeah, that was an absolute no-no. She also co-starred on the final season of the crime drama Hunter. And what is cool is that the LA Police Department included her in a 2010 event celebrating female police officers. They celebrated her because of the influence she had on inspiring women to become police officers.
Ah, that's nice.
We talked last week about Rose Marie, star of the Dick Van Dyke Show, or I say last week, but it was the last time we talked about celebrity deaths because that was a couple weeks ago. But that same time that Rose Marie was dying, also another actor with a Dick Van Dyke, a couple connections to Dick Van Dyke, one of them no less than being his brother, Jerry Van Dyke, died.
Yes.
At 86.
I heard this. At 86. And I had just watched the old Dick Van Dyke episode where Jerry is playing Dick's brother, who can only be highly entertaining on the banjo when he's asleep. He's a sleepwalker who's very entertaining, but when he's awake, he doesn't know how to play banjo and is tongue-tied. Hilarious.
Yeah,
two-part episode.
So hilarious. I mean, you know, Dick Van Dyke obviously cast a very large shadow. But Jerry Van Dyke was hilarious. And yet it took decades for him to achieve his own stardom. And it didn't come really until he played Craig T. Nelson's dim-witted sidekick in the TV sitcom Coach.
Coach, yeah. But he had had an extensive stage show, and he was performing in comedy clubs and revues and bars all over the Americas.
But he really was probably best known, other than being Dick Van Dyke's brother, as kind of the butt of joking footnotes, really, because, you know, these trivia, like answer to trivia questions, because he, you know, he was the star of 1965's My Mother the Car, which has gone down in history as just one of the big jokes, right? Because its premise was a small town lawyer talks to his deceased mother. The voice actress playing the deceased mother was none other than Anne Southern, by the way. But she speaks from the radio of an antique automobile. And this kind of ludicrous premise made it such a joke through the years. And yet, are you kidding me? Like, that's the premise for a big budget movie now.
Totally. I know. Jeez. I know. I'm listening. That sounds like a pitch.
Yeah, no, come on.
On the edge of my seat.
Don't kid yourself. That would have made it through the pitch meetings in the X-Files story room.
Totally.
As a one-off episode, that would have absolutely done that.
Oh, yeah.
But his decision to take the lead role in My Mother the Car was really one of two disastrous career moves that he made in the 1960s.
Wow. What was the other one?
Well, he took that at the urging of his brother, Dick Van Dyke, who said, yeah, I really like that script about the car. So he passed on playing a character named Gilligan in a show called Gilligan's Island.
No!
He also turned down the opportunity to replace Don Knotts as the deputy on the Andy Griffith Show.
Oh. Actually, I could see the Andy Griffith Show being a really good fit for him, actually.
Yeah, but I guess he just didn't want to follow in someone else's footsteps. My Mother the Car lasted one season. Gilligan's Island, of course, turned Bob Denver into an icon. In fairness, you know, Bob Denver had had a good career before that, right? The many loves of Dobie Gillis. And it's not like Bob Denver really got to do a lot after, right? Gilligan's
That's
Island.
True.
So, I mean, I wonder, you know, we can't ask him, but I wonder in retrospect if Jerry Van Dyke would have done it any other way, given that he did achieve such great success in Coach, and maybe he enjoyed having it towards the later part of his life rather than in the 1960s. You know, he always sure seemed a lot more healthy and happy than his brother did, although his brother's still alive.
That's for sure.
I mean, you mentioned the great Dick Van Dyke episode. He also made guest appearances on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. He did do a guest spot on the Andy Griffith Show and was so hilarious in all of these. And you can see him do a little bit more of a dramatic thing in Perry Mason. But he turns up in a lot of great shows over the years as a supporting actor, you know, as a guest actor.
Yeah. So sorry. Yeah.
all right, moving to music. Denise LaSalle, who was a singer known as the Queen of the Blues, is dead.
No.
Age 78. Again, when someone who is considered the Queen of the Blues dies, shouldn't that get some headlines? Shouldn't it?
You would think. Yeah. Maybe it came on the same day as something else.
She was born in Mississippi. I think the president tweeted some things that day.
Oh, that would do it.
She was born in Mississippi in 1939, sang in church choirs before moving to Chicago, where she performed with top musicians and even wrote songs. She was signed to the legendary Chess Records in 1967. Her first single, A Love Reputation, what a great name, huh? A Love Reputation, was a regional hit. She wrote and recorded her 1971 hit, Trapped by a Thing Called Love, and it was released by Westbound Records in Detroit, and the track reached all the way to number 13 on the Hot 100 and was number one on the Billboard R&B chart. It came back to prominence because it was included on President Obama's 2016 Summer Nights playlist. Her last record was released in 2010, and she continued with her live performances throughout. In 2015, she was inducted into the R&B Music Hall of Fame.
Wow.
Now, I'm going to play a little trivia question with you and see if you can name this without looking this up. I'm going to give you a name. You're going to tell me who it is. Oh. See if you can take a guess, and I'll give you hints if you need them.
Oh, good. Yes, I'll probably need them.
Dave Toschi has died at the age of 86. Who is Dave Toschi, Dean Haglund?
He's the guy who was in the Godzilla outfit.
Think San Francisco. Who is Dave Toschi, Dean Haglund?
San Francisco. He's the guy who designed the Transamerica building.
I love these. This is actually fun. This is how we should do this more often. We can turn your year 12 will be a game show. This is awesome. We could just like throw these back and forth. We each go and pull a couple of like celebrity deaths and
right,
and we'll keep track of points. I love it. Or have listeners send in the but anyway. All right. Production meeting on the air. Okay.
Dave Toschi,
I'm going to give you
the
third and final clue.
Okay.
Serial killer case. Think serial killer case. Dave Toschi, San Francisco serial killer case.
So he
I'll give you one more. What were you going to say? What were you going to say?
He solved the Zodiac murder, except that's never been solved.
You're right on about it being the Zodiac killer case. It never was officially solved in that the killer was never caught. So, do you want to go a little bit deeper? Go a little bit further.
Yeah, I'll take one more clue. I'll take one more clue.
Well, it was going to be the year.
60.
It was going to be the year, but you already know that this is the Zodiac killer of the 1960s and early 70s.
What did Dave Toschi do for it?
Well, that's what I want you to tell me. I mean, you're very close. You're very, very close.
He was the psychic.
No, he was the detective. He was the detective in charge of the case. After a taxi driver was shot to death in October of 1969, five people had already been fatally stabbed or shot to death prior to that. And this Zodiac killer who sent taunting letters and cryptograms to the police and newspapers took credit for it. So then when this taxi driver was shot to death in October 69, Dave Toschi was put on the case. He was taken off 9 years later. And also, I'm going to hold on why he was taken off the case 9 years later. I guess my other clue could have been for you that Mark Ruffalo could have been the other clue. Because that's the actor who played him in the 2011 movie Zodiac. Do you want to guess at why he was taken off the case?
There was another serial killer.
He was taken off the case because it was revealed, and he later admitted that this revelation was true, that he was writing and mailing anonymous fan letters about himself to the San Francisco Chronicle that were getting published.
Oh, no. Oh. That, you know, I mean, who hasn't done that?
But it's different when you're doing it in chat rooms and things like that. You know?
Yeah. Boy, Dean Haglund's a great guy.
I drop in, right? Well. John Columbus drops in, and because that's middle name in the street I grew up on, drops in to tell people one, I've got fudge, and two, Phil Ayres is a talent.
He's got a talent. He's kind of a big deal.
All right, let's do it. This was kind of fun. All right, who is Edward Fast Eddie Clark? This person is dead at the age of 67. Who is Edward Fast Eddie Clark, Dean Haglund?
Fast Eddie, isn't that a gambler of some sort? He gambled.
You're thinking Eddie Felsen in The Hustler, I think.
Oh, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Damn it.
Okay.
Okay.
Musician.
I'll take a clue.
Musician.
Yeah. Musician. That's... So he's a musician. Is that
yes.
close enough?
No, I just told you he was a musician. You now have to guess.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit of something
fast.
About him.
Oh, yeah. Fast. Oh, he was a keyboard. He was really fast on the piano.
All right. British hard rock band Motorhead's lead guitarist, Edward Fast Eddie Clark, dead at 67. He joined Motorhead in 1975, and he was the final survivor of the band's classic lineup.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that at all.
Okay.
That the well, how sad.
Okay.
So Motorhead's no more.
Is this fun? Is it fun for you? I mean, you've got no chance on some of these because they don't get publicized. But still, isn't that the point? Like, Motorhead was a big deal. I mean,
I know.
And don't kid yourself. I might get Dave Toschi. I certainly, in a couple of the clues, would have. But these are hard. These are really hard. Doreen Tracy has died, age 74. My clue for you is cute as a button.
Wow. Doreen Tracy, cute as a button. Cute as a button.
Why would she
be
famous?
The last surviving...
Oh.
Last surviving member of the Partridge Family?
That's not a bad guess. That's not a bad guess. You're going way too...
Okay.
Giving her way too much credit, though, for being last surviving. She was a child star. You're absolutely right about that. And it was on a television show. But
it was.
But the decade is the 1950s. So do you want to guess what that TV show was?
Mr. Ed?
She has a career credit in common with star of La La Land, Ryan Gosling.
Young Hercules. Oh, no. That's.
They were both Mouseketeers. She was one of the original Mouseketeers.
Oh.
But this is what's cute. She maintained her ties to Disney through and show business throughout her life. She appeared in some films like Westward Ho, The Wagons, and she toured with the Mouseketeers. Uh-huh. But she later served as a publicist to musician Frank Zappa. And worked as a publicist at Warner Brothers. So that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
All right.
That's great.
Now, here's one that I definitely would get. This man's voice, really one of my favorites. So I've given you a clue there. Keith Jackson. Keith Jackson has died at 89. I mentioned his voice. What was Keith Jackson famous for? Dean Haglund. And should we
voice.
Tell should we tell everyone what charity you're playing for, Dean?
The Team Fuzz Aldrin.
good for you. GoFundMe.com. Save Fuzz Aldrin. Well, we're going to have to give you good clues for this one then, because it's going for a good cause. Keith Jackson.
Jackson. It was a voiceover or voice musician? Oh, that's cheating. I can't ask. So I'm going to say he's the voice of Mr. Clean.
Signature phrase. One of his signature phrases was, "Whoa, Nelly."
Oh, Nelly. Oh, my God. Was that a commercial?
He spent 5 decades working in this particular field.
Oof. Now I'm really embarrassed. I don't know this guy. Keith Jackson, 5 decades in the field of Whoa, Nelly. He's a radio DJ then.
A native of rural West Virginia, a smooth baritone. He used phrases like big uglies for the people who played a particular position in a particular sport.
Oh, he was a sports announcer for, whoa, Nelly. Oh, yes, I can hear it now. He is the baseball.
He did almost every sport, but he really kind of goes down in history as the voice of college football. His death came just 3 weeks after another sports casting icon that we talked about, and I expressed my real admiration and affection for, because, among other things, he had been the voice of the UCLA Bruins back during the John Wooden era, Dick Enberg. Uh-huh. Okay, let's do... boy, this is actually fun. This is actually... I hope it's fun
it's
for
really
you. Is it
hard,
fun?
Though? Yeah. Well, I feel terrible that I don't know them, but then this is why we do this.
This is why we... Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. I don't know these, yeah.
Let me give you one more, and then we'll end there, because this one's really quite... Neither of us would get this, but this is super cool. Anna May Hayes, who died at age 97, Dean, will be remembered in the history books as the first female what? Anna May Hayes died at 97, the first female what? And it is the first female in U.S. history. She's an American, okay? Just so you know.
Okay.
So the first female what, Dean?
Let's see. If she's 97, so that was 20, so 60 years of 1940. So she's the first female World War II bombing pilot.
Oh, wow. You went the right route.
Did I really?
She it does involve the U.S. military, though she was not a combat soldier, which I don't know if you consider a pilot, a combat soldier. She was in the medical corps. So the first female, what?
Medic. The first female field medic?
The first female general in United States history. On June 11th, 1970, she was chief of the U.S. Army Nurse Corps, and she became the first woman to be promoted to the one-star rank of Brigadier General, beating Elizabeth P. Hoisington, who was chief of the Women's Army Corps, by a matter of minutes.
Oh, no. Minutes?
Yes.
I feel sorry for Ms. Hoisington.
But that's pretty great, huh? I mean, you talk, there are glass ceilings and there are glass ceilings. And so General Anna May Hayes died at 97. What a remarkable woman, I imagine, this person was.
Yeah.
This actually makes me want to research her. And I to achieve that and to see the things that she saw, and you know, both in terms of on the field of battle, but also through history, right? I mean, she had a front row seat.
Yeah, so many changes.
So many amazing changes. Yeah, I can only hope that there's a biopic in the works of a woman like that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, maybe
not,
we got
that script.
Yeah, maybe we got to it. Interesting. 1971 is the same year that a bulk of our Royal Raymond Rife script is set, if I'm not mistaken, because I think
true.
That was the year he died. Yeah. So we have an affinity for that era.
That's right.
All right.
Are we doing with our time?
Speaking of outstanding award-winning segues, welcome back to the show, Corporate Branding's very own Mark Hirschhahn. What are you working on right now?
I can only speak in general terms due to the various NDAs I'm forced to sign for these projects until they actually come out in the world.
Did you come up with the term NDA for non-disclosure agreements? Was that one of yours?
Because that's a good one. That is good. I used a lot.
I have to say I did not claim that. I'm sorry. but I wish I had, because a lot of people use it. But no, I'm working with, there's a major new healthcare endeavor that's about to be unleashed cool. that I've had something to do with. There is how do I say this? This is very sort of secret at the moment. Let's just say it's something that you use in a seated position that goes at a very fast rate of speed.
That I've been working. You're naming a masturbating machine? What the hell?
God darn it. Can you guys cut this? Can you cut this? I can't have that going out there.
I can't imagine what possible names it would come up with.
Oh, yeah, I think you can imagine. You're an improviser. You've been through this drill before.
Mark was instrumental in naming the pop-up comedy club that I ran here in Sydney,
that's
Australia.
Right.
The Hilarium. Right. And I got to say, right. the docket you sent, because I just gave you what? It's a comedy club. There's a bar below it.
Yeah.
I didn't give you a lot of information, but the 140-odd names that you gave, plus somehow you found the location and then put what the logo would look like
that's
on
right.
the location.
Right.
That was awesome. So then when I showed that around to get, you know, yeah, everybody thought yeah. I was a real businessman.
Well, I'm glad. It sounded like the show you guys had there, it went pretty well from what you were saying.
Yeah, it went really well. The rents here are a bit astronomical. So we are... Oh. Theoretically looking for another space at the moment. But of the 140 names that you sent, the Hilarium tested the best. Though Antix, oddly enough, A-N-T-I-X, was also in the running for...
Don't mention the ones you did not choose, Dean Haglund. You're giving away free names.
That's right. I can resell those to other comedy club people.
Have I got a name for you?
Actually, I think Antix.
Because they're very well healed, and they just come in the door, and I can just rip those people off.
I think you're missing a real obvious opportunity, all joking aside, gentlemen. I think you're missing a real obvious opportunity. Let me just say this phrase to let you know what I'm thinking. Consult your physician to see if Antix is right for you.
Masturbating drug?
It's a high-speed masturbating drug. Exactly. It's in your wheelhouse. It's right back into your sweet spot, Mark Hirschman. So we know Hilarium. We know Swiffer. We know Dasani. We've gone through these when you've been on the show before. We know Pentium Processor. We know...
Blackberry.
We know Princess Cruise Line. We know...
no! You didn't do Princess Cruise Line?
We know Men
No,
at
I
work. We know
what? Bayer aspirin.
Bayer aspirin. We know slippery when wet.
No.
We know.
No, I know. No.
Okay, but I want to ask, and this doesn't have to be with your new I hope the NDA doesn't cover this. I don't know how long these NDAs cover, and honestly, I don't care. But
once the thing comes out, then I can talk.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, good. So maybe don't include the work you're doing for your current employer, because they still just might not be happy about it. But has something you've come up with ever been adopted and used, and yet you didn't even like it? You know, because you do give so many suggestions. Yeah. Like we just mentioned, you gave Dean like 140 possibilities. But I would imagine...
And maybe Hilarium wasn't your favorite.
But do you ever, so I guess my first question is, when you're coming up with that long list, do you ever stack it? Like, look, when I'm expected, for example, to give ideas on casting certain roles, and I want your top 10 choices. Well, guess what? Only three of my choices in that top 10 do I actually like. Mm-hmm. And I am padding with ones intentionally I don't want you to choose to build up the ones that I do like. Is there anything
we do the same thing in a naming presentation where we've got names that certainly fulfill the brief, the thing that you know are trying to say with the name, but we often use it to sort of set the boundaries of how far a name can go, either conservatively or far out. And those names typically are names that we probably wouldn't go with. And they're really designed to get the client to kind of focus on the names that we feel are really delivering on the proposition.
Right.
Whether it's a product or service.
To direct
company,
them,
whatever.
Direct them in a particular way. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're pretty good at it. And I don't know that there's ever been a name that a client selected where I just said, this one isn't, because I don't think I'd show any name in a presentation that a client shouldn't pick or that I would hope they wouldn't pick. Because I mean, we generate of the 140 that you saw, Dean, I probably generated about 500. And so I winnow down a list and I send you the names that I think, you know, some of these are real outliers and some of them aren't very good, but they help to kind of show you the playing field.
Right. For sure.
But any of those names, depending
you
how
mean,
you
strategize. You're telling me that the man who co-authored I Hate People, known, known miscreant, Mark Hirschhorn, has never had it so in for any client that he didn't sharp his axe with some really bad
dogs.
Naming in order to drive down that nemesis's corporate profits. Yeah.
I think I may have told you this story. There was a project I had that I like to do some names in there that are kind of jokes for me that I get a big laugh out of. Anderson Spence. One of those did get selected, and I can talk about this because the company's defunct now. Not, I don't think because of me, but you remember Saturn Cards?
Yes.
Sure. Yeah.
They had a. And I named a couple of models of theirs, and one of them was their SUV. They said, we're going to make an SUV. And so they made this SUV. And as they're briefing us on the thing, it turns out the thing didn't have four-wheel drive. it didn't have any of the stuff an SUV really needed, but it looked like an SUV. And I said, so where can people take this thing? They said, well, you know, they could drive it on roads and stuff. I said, well, can they off-road with it? Oh, no. They'd get stuck in an instant. And so I said, so
stuck in an instant. One of the names
I had was the Saturn View, V-U-E, because I said, you can go to where you can watch other people off-roading.
No way.
Yeah. So that was the name that got picked.
That is the name that got picked. I remember the Saturn View.
So Saturn is no more, and it serves them right because it infuriated me. It seriously infuriated me that they never had as an advertising slogan even once Saturn running rings around the competition. They never played. They never. No, I'm serious. That pissed me off. Not that it would be good, but I mean, honestly, it's Saturn, for crying out loud. That's what we think of when we think of the. It's the big one with the rings.
And why didn't they just name every model after a moon of Saturn?
Yeah, why didn't they do that? I don't. You know what? It's funny though, because like if you think of Nike, you know, very famous brand Nike, they never talk about Nike being the Greek goddess of victory. So that association, if you know that from mythology, that's great, but they have never made a point of saying that, which I think is actually kind of a cool thing. It's like a brand. It's like a brand name with an Easter egg, you know?
Right. I always got the feeling that Saturn, like they were thinking so exclusively the god that they went, oh, right. There's a planet. Oh, news we could have used.
The Saturn View. You could watch other cars go off-roading. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Saturn, the first car into space, the space between existing and not existing as a brand anymore.
Right. Driving and fun. Yeah.
And I'm sure we've asked you before, but maybe you're at liberty to have different answers now, and then we'll get off branding. But any particularly great ideas that you loved that were not chosen for whatever reason?
That's a great question. And I really should have a few of these in my pocket that I can always just pull out and go, yeah, here's one. Here's a stinker I really hated. Invariably, when I present to a client, it just weirdly turns out that whatever names the client likes, I seem to really like.
Oh, cool.
That's because you're you're lazy, Mark. That's the sign of.
I no, like this. So do I.
It's because I'm a yes man. I love that name too.
Because I don't bite the hand that feeds me. I am not a revolutionary in any way, shape, or form. Okay. Well, then how about we turn it around to a challenge? You said you wished you had a pocket where you could pull these answers out of. What would you name that pocket?
Close in name would be Name Pocket.
That's very good. Name Pocket.
Outside name would be ominously The Void.
Oh, well, that hit him in the old Name Pocket, Bob. We don't want to. Okay.
Oh yeah. Call it The Void.
Now, we've talked before in the past about you being a comedy entrepreneur, Mark Hirschhorn. I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know if we used that word before. Yeah. That's a new word I'm branding. I came up with that.
I produced. Yes.
And recently you were moderating a panel with Danny McBride and Jody Hill, right, at Sketchfest?
Yes, at the just recently concluded San Francisco Sketchfest. Yes.
So what else has been going on in terms of answer Dean's question of how did that go, and answer my question of what other comedy endeavors are you teaching improv, for example, still?
I am. But to answer Dean's question, it went great. They were doing a tribute screening of the first movie that Danny McBride and Jody Hill did, which was The Foot Fist Way, which is martial arts spoof, right? It's about kickboxing Taekwondo. And it was a desperation move from them. I mean, they couldn't get arrested for either acting in Danny's case or movie making in Jody's case. So they scraped all the money they could get together. They, of course, you know, did the whole max out your credit card thing. And they shot this little movie. And it caught the attention of Adam McKay and Will Ferrell.
Right.
And the rest kind of is history. I mean, ever since then, they've just been able to do kind of whatever they want, explore projects, write movies, television. They did, you know, three seasons of Eastbound and Down on HBO. Vice Principals just concluded. That was, you know, two seasons on HBO. And these guys were just delightful. You know, you might get the feeling, because Danny McBride's characters tend to be very close to the sort of same
dickish.
Beat. Yeah. Dickish kind of swaggering oaf that doesn't seem to care about anybody. But there's shades of it, and it's gotten deeper as he's done the character over the years. We talked about this on stage, but in person, he's nothing like that character.
Oh, you're kidding.
Nicest guy in the world. They both are. And well, I had a great time with both of them, which was terrific. And then, you might know these improvisers, Dean. Earlier that day, I got called in at last minute to moderate another panel with some of the folks from the Speechless show on ABC. And the Speechless show, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Dean.
It's
an ABC sitcom, but the main character is a kid, a high school kid with cerebral palsy, and he doesn't speak. He can't talk. He's in a wheelchair and has to speak with one of those boards where you like point a light at letters and somebody reads it. And Minnie Driver plays his mother on the show, and she was.
Okay.
But Cedric Yarborough was there.
Yes.
He plays the kid's attendant on the show, and the guy who plays the dad, I'd never heard of him before, but his name is, I'm going to forget. It's David Bauer.
David Bauer.
Was hilarious. I mean, nonstop hilarious. Just in this interview. But that was great. I love getting to do stuff with other improvisers, because you just feel that vibe as soon as you start talking to them.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
you can take the conversation anywhere, which is just fantastic.
I haven't seen this at all, actually, so I got to look for it.
Yeah. It's interesting. I watched a couple of episodes. It's not something I was aware of. And they called me and said, hey, can you do this? So I watched a couple of episodes, and it's pretty interesting, because the challenge of having a main character who doesn't talk is really very interesting. As the actor said on the panel, they said, we all have to learn his lines, because we have to say what he's spelling out on his board.
And is there an improvised element to the show?
I asked them that, and they said, we do get to play around a little bit, but because of the structure of having to, you know what this kid is spelling out, we have to keep those lines the way they are, because all that stuff is kind of wrapped up in how the rhythm of the lines go and things like that. But when he's not in a scene, we're freer to do some playing around and stuff.
I kind of love, you were kind enough to help me with one of the acting intensives that I was teaching. You came in and introduced some improv games. And it was really fun because, Dean, these actors, they were doing these improv games not as themselves. They were doing it as the characters that they had been assigned for the week and that they were exploring from scripted material. And so the exercises were to give them some tools that they can use when exploring their characters, not just using the text, obviously, not just doing scene breakdowns, but learning how to embody the character in different situations, right? And so that was really interesting. But one of the things that I love, Mark, is when there are games that have some kind of strict wall to them, for lack of a better word, that to me, those scenes with that boy would be where you know you have to have these scripted lines. And those would be the ones where if they incorporated improv, that I would really find potentially very interesting.
That is, Dean, it would be a lot like that improv game Playbook, you know, where one guy has the script and the other person's just improvising.
Yeah.
It would be a lot like that, which is always a lot of fun. To get back to your earlier question, Phil, I am teaching improv, not publicly, but I'm actually teaching at work. So at the branding studio I work at, I teach a class once a week at lunch for whoever wants to come and learn. It's an open-ended class. And I'm just teaching the basic improv skills.
You're kidding. And you're teaching that to corporate guys in suits?
No, they're not corporate. These are like graphic designers. There's other people in the verbal department where I am, where we do naming and messaging and stuff. There's accountants from that will come down and play. The marketing people will come down. It's kind of a mixed bag every week, depending on people's schedules. I'm just running through games and kind of the basic precepts of improv, how it all works. And the amazing thing is, and this is why I'm doing it, I'm in the course of very slowly writing a book about improv for business.
Right.
Not that people haven't talked about this before, but what I'm seeing is this fascinating byproduct where these people, they tend to work in their own silos in the studio. The graphic designers pretty much stick with the graphic designers, right? They're all in one area. But now, because they've been playing with other people across other disciplines, now in the studio they're beginning to interact more, and they're inviting other people over that are from another department to look at some work or to kind of give their opinion of something,
brain work on stage.
Exactly. So it's really fascinating.
Well, I have a friend, Mark, who I found this out maybe a year ago, a couple years ago, and she worked marketing for a major publishing company. And the entire marketing team was sent to a week retreat for improv training. And I was jazzed by it, finding that out, because I remember, I mean, we met, first time I met you, Mark, was when you interviewed us right before we had the American premiere of The Truth Is Out There. And a big part of The Truth Is Out There for me that I had not expected was this through line about how the skill set that Dean learned and embodied through improv is a skill set that enables us to navigate the ever-shifting cultural and currents, political currents and current, you know, all these changes at a time when everything seems to be speeding up so much. And the skills that he embodied and demonstrated are very much the skill set for survival in the 21st century, it seemed to me. And that was not something that I had anticipated when we went into making that documentary. And now these years later, to hear that this idea of improv training was deemed as really important in the corporate world reminded me that
exactly boy, why
good ideas tend to get proved when companies can figure out, oh, this can make us money.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, you know, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Dean.
Well, if you're writing a book, I'm down here with a couple of senior improvisers. We're designing how to use improv not only as a team building, but as a group think to outthink AI that's coming for your job. Because the AI is, while it can outthink you based on having a huge array of information at its fingertips, it can't intuitively quite yet form the third way. So we're developing corporate improv of how to, in a boardroom, improvise to the third direction, not a binary A-B, but a C.
Wow. That's heavy.
And I think you'll find that, yeah. Well, you'll see that in certain improv games, in certain stuff, that there's it goes in a direction that no one could have had ever steered. But if you can always get that, then you can always outthink AI.
That's a fascinating principle. There's another speechless show which Phil is aware of. I don't know if you know about it, Dean. It's a friend of mine started here in San Francisco. It's an improvised PowerPoint show. And he's spun off in a bunch of different directions, and he's working with a neuroscientist who's trying to study the effect of humor on brain waves and how it helps us, whether it helps people think or actually keeps them from being able to think quickly, which would seem to be antithetical. But he's been putting people in an MRI machine and have them improvising in an MRI machine for an hour.
Okay. Have you been in an MRI machine?
I will not go in one. He tried to get me to do it. I said, I won't do it. But he's gotten a few people to do it. And he says there's a discernible change in brain waves when they're doing improv, that the entire brain thing lights up and it becomes much more active than people that are either just talking or they're just being still or they're reading or whatever other activity there is. He says they've never seen the kind of activity that occurs when people are improvising because they're drawing from so many different parts of the brain to respond and to give offers and those sort of things.
I
was contacted by Sony Robotics back in the early 2000s, and they asked me exactly. Basically, they're trying to mimic how improvisers think, so that they can have their robotics improvise in situations that they find themselves.
Oh my God! We're gonna program the improvisation.
We're gonna program.
Are you talking sex robots?
No, these were emergency, those life-saving robots. So,
What would you name an improvising sex robot, Mark Hirschhorn, branding expert, Mark Hirschhorn? What would you name that? Just as there are shower singers, you know, people who sing very well in the shower but can't do it in front of an audience, I am an MRI chamber improviser.
That's your specialty.
I love that idea. That's fantastic.
What's the name of the book going to be, Mark? You must have a name. You must have a really good name, like I Hate People.
It's not I Hate People. It's actually the name I've been doing my classes under, which is Unthink.
That's pretty good.
The idea that you have to kind of break down the way that you've been taught to think so you can learn how to unthink. And I mean, because when you're starting out doing improv, the last thing you need is your brain trying to think ahead of where you're going to be, because it just doesn't work that way.
Right. So you have to kind of blocking.
So you have to reteach your brain how to think in a whole new different way. So I call it unthink because the whole process involves with, first of all, I have to teach you how to stop doing what you've been doing for most of your life, to teach you what you used to do when you were a kid. Because that's really the way improv works. It's the way your brain worked on imagination when you were a child.
Exactly. So interesting. And what sort of games are you doing? Real basic stuff like Word at a Time and Switch and all that sort of things? Or are you
just simpler? Just stuff out of the book, you know, out of the any typical handbook of improv games and skills and stuff. And I've you know, come up with a few things that are sort of germane to branding and stuff. Like, you know, you've done ad agency before where guys are sitting around and you're coming up with an ad campaign on stage. Well, we do it just in terms of a branding campaign, which is very similar, but it's very specific to the skill set of the people that are in the class.
Oh, far out.
I want to ask you, I want to ask both of you guys about a documentary, if you don't mind. Came across my radar. It's not a recent documentary. I think it's 2009, but it came across my radar just today. And it's a documentary about an improv comedy team called Trust Us, This Is All Made Up.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of this, but I've never been able to find it. Where did
me neither.
I haven't yet to see it. I was told to watch it. The comedy team is, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this man's name right. I mean, I know him. I know his work, especially from all those Sonic commercials, the drive-in food. But TJ Jagodowski.
I know who that is.
And his comedy partner was David Pasquesi, who played most recently, I guess, Selena Meyer's on again, off again ex-husband on Veep, right? Plays the father of his daughter, of her daughter. And I first knew him as Stu the Meat Man on Strangers with Candy. They were an improv team. I don't know if they still are. And anyway, it's a documentary about their work together. And I thought that conversation, asking two, I don't know, if there's a Rushmore of improv comedy, the two of you certainly have gone and visited the Rushmore of improv comedy. Look, what did you think I was going to say? You were on it? No. I mean, you would care to go and look at it, which is something that normal people wouldn't care to do. Why do we want to see carved faces of improv comics? But to each his own, guys.
I like carving.
But I thought this would lead to a wonderful conversation about it, and sometimes I'm wrong. So...
Well, but there's also a movie out, right, where there's a New York improv group, and one of the guys makes it to a SNL TV show.
That's Birbiglia's movie, right? The
Don't Think Twice. And this is
I loved it. I thought it was great.
I didn't see that either.
Did you see it, Dean?
No, and I'm looking forward to seeing it.
You know, they have some stuff that will be very recognizable. They have some stuff that seemed to be like, well, this is something we have to do to a movie to make it realistic. But the idea that one guy hits it big, right? It's Key from Key and Peele, he gets plucked out by a Saturday Night Live type show, and how it kind of implodes the entire group.
Right, when the dynamic they all get jealous and petty and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's a surprisingly touching film, and I thought, it's important because some of the characters seem very rooted in authenticity. Some of them,
but I always worry, because I watched that early days of the Comedy Store thing, whatever that was called, with there was a Mitzi Short type, and there was a comic.
The one on Showtime?
Yeah.
Showtime, yeah. What was that series called?
Yeah, I'm Dying Up Here.
I'm Dying Up Here. And so as great as the acting was, there's always something about seeing actors, even when they are doing a great job as a stand-up, there's always a cushion of air of faultness or something. And I was worried that the improv thing would be the same.
The good actors in that show are the ones that happen to be comedians. Rick, our friend Rick Overton plays the talent booker for The Tonight Show on there. And his stuff's great. The young people playing the comedians never come off to me believably as comedians.
Exactly. And that's everything I've ever seen about stand-up comedy as always never come across. Even Dustin Hoffman as Lenny Bruce in Lenny.
Right,
the amazing actor, there's still a pocket of air of I'm not buying it. And
although as a lousy comic, I will put Robert De Niro as Rupert Pumpkin as a great bad comedian.
But didn't he just play a stand-up comic in something? Didn't he revisit?
The movie bombed horribly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, another one. What was that called? Yeah, yeah.
But
he was playing like just old.
Just last.
But not a. Yeah. But that's the thing is that.
It was also the same feel.
Yeah. I have a kind of an odd question, but still related to improv for both of you. You know, we talk about clearly improv. We talked about how it's being taught in corporate settings. Mark's teaching it in corporate settings. We're talking about movies where it's not just being incorporated into the making of the movie, but it's the topic of the movie itself. What avenue, what field, let's say, what maybe professional field or where do each of you wish that improv comedy was taught?
Was
politics?
Politics.
So
no, I think that's is already a big thing in politics.
No, but don't. I mean, actually was one of the things I thought of. Was wouldn't it be great? I mean, wouldn't that break down some barriers? It couldn't make conversation and communication less likely. You know, it couldn't at this point,
right,
obviously.
Exactly.
But any others where you wish it was?
Well, you know what. For my thinking, I wish it was taught in sort of the pre-social media elementary school kids growing up. Mm. I think there would be a lot of skill sets that you would be able to acquire from having improv taught to kids before they get themselves stuck inside a little 5-inch screen and are communicating, texting, and bullying each other. And, you know, getting into suicidal depression, if they had a pre-skill set of communicating, eye contact, thinking, developing all those skills.
And I think, you know, I think improv is popping up in those settings. I've just got invited to an improv show at the local high school here next week. And it's 6 or 8 kids that have put an improv group together. And I'll be curious to see what it looks like. It could be horrible, but it certainly will be interesting.
You know,
here in Sydney, it's definitely intrinsic in all the school systems that most of the improvisers here teach at schools a lot.
Oh, really?
But they teach, yeah, but at the high school level, I mean, you're already at a kind of goofy, joshy. There's already a smartass. There's already but to bring it down like to 4th or 5th grade area where it's sort of where you're just coming into that, I think would be even more advantageous.
Well, no, I think it's brilliant, and it dovetails with something that we've talked about from time to time. Usually, whenever there is a major gun incident, right, a big gun massacre somewhere, and we talk about how shameful it is that access to mental health care is so much more difficult than access to getting a gun. And I've brought that up before, and some people who, and when I say people, I mean people with guns, will point out that I have a point, except that the gunman in question was receiving mental health care, right? Did have access to it. And they miss the point that I'm making, which is we're not getting easy access to health care early enough for people.
Right,
we need to take the stigma away where something has to be wrong before you can reach out and or receive that kind of training and skill set. And something like an improv setting, fantastic. The tools that they're learning that can help cope with problems and can help interact with people and communication, but also from the point of view of their teachers and school psychologists, what they can learn about how that student's mind and creativity works could make them more easily able to help that particular student with their particular unique needs, it would seem. Because I would imagine, Mark, you learn a lot in a short period of time, don't you, about the people that you teach?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the first drills I ever do with a class is, you know, this game called Name Ball, where they're throwing an imaginary ball back and forth, and they throw their own name. I think we did this in your class because we were trying to get people to kind of learn each other's characters' names they were doing. And within 5 minutes, all of a sudden, people that didn't know anything about anybody else, they suddenly know everybody's name. They can learn 20 names in 5 to 10 minutes. And from the get-go, they all of a sudden now are on literally a first-name basis with 20 new people.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
I would love to see improv a required element of being a healthcare professional. Especially in America. Look, I don't know what healthcare is like in other countries, obviously, but at least here in America, I wish that. I think yes anding would be a really valuable skill set, if nothing else, for healthcare professionals, because it would force them, hopefully, to listen more to not only each
right.
other, but to the people that they're supposed to be helping.
Absolutely.
And it would aid in bedside manner and compassion and empathy in all those ways. So that's where I would like to see it.
Right. Because
go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say, to sort of give a blanket answer to your earlier question, Phil, I would like to see it sort of, you know, offered in almost any profession. I mean, I use it every day in my profession, talking with clients. One of my principles of improv in business is you are always performing. Even if it's you across the desk from another person, there's a performance happening. And sometimes you're the performer and sometimes you're the audience. And oftentimes you're both, and it's switching back and forth. But if you're aware there's a performance going on, all of a sudden you can start to see, well, where's this performance going? What's the form of it? How's my staging looking? Do I look like a slob? Am I, if I'm in a job interview, I'm performing.
Right.
And so the idea that you're learning how to perform through doing improv suddenly gives you this whole skill set you didn't have coming out of business school.
Yeah, fascinating.
That's so true.
Fascinating.
So you need that performance.
The
persona and your persona.
The final thing I'd love to talk about with you, Mark, tonight is I know you to be interested in anything you talk about, you're so interested in. It doesn't matter, like, for example, how bad the television show. Like, I asked Mark on the phone the other night, I asked him if he'd seen Seth MacFarlane's what the hell is the name of that show called? The space thing?
Orville.
The Orville, yeah.
Okay, the Orville. And yeah. I asked if he'd seen it. And he said, yeah, you know, I've watched all the episodes. And you could tell that it was an interesting topic to him to discuss. He's hated the show. He just thinks it's terrible. And yet he was interested talking about it. And I'm curious, what is there out there, Mark, that you want to do, that you want to pursue, that maybe you haven't done or pursued? What's beyond the next hill, the next horizon?
I think that's a great question, and I don't want to cop out, but in an improv style, I'm ready for whatever comes along. I mean, I want to write, I want to go back to writing screenplays. I want to do TV shows. I've got a bunch of irons in the fire that, you know, might turn into something, who knows. But as far
modern
as going,
dance.
What is the next
modern
thing?
Modern dance. Are we talking modern dance?
You know, it hadn't occurred, but now that you bring it up, yes. And I'd love to get a leopard skin leotard.
That is the perfect embodiment of embracing what wants to come forward.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's our
but
friend.
That's really the way it works. I mean,
Mark Hirschhorn. That's the way it works.
That's how it works.
Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for being such a good friend to the show, to us. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in San Jose on Wednesday, February 21st.
I am looking forward to seeing you and Lily in the movie. It's going to be great. Can't wait to see Lady Killers on the big screen. I've only seen it on a screener you sent me. So I can't wait to see it on a big screen. It's going to be great.
And I'm sure there's some changes.
I'm sorry,
there's
I won't
also
be there.
Some changes. You might. How do you know you won't be there? You need to have more of a Mark Hirschhorn-esque embrace what wants to come forward attitude, Dean Hagler. You'll be too busy. You'll be too busy with your brand new bionic knee visiting the improv Mount Rushmore again.
Dean, you should always say what I say when I can't be somewhere. Say, I will be there in spirit, so save me a ghost seat.
Ah, hey, that is good. And or scary, but one of the two.
I would have been there, but I didn't want to go. That's the one I like to say.
That's Phil's patented no but.
No but.
And if you could see me, you would know I'm wearing my no but pants.
From Henderson's?
They're Henderson's.
No butt pants. No.
Worried that an improv worried that an improv class might break out and ruin your otherwise dull drab day. Wear Henderson's no butt pants.
A pair of no butt pants.
No,
they're just assless chaps, but don't tell anyone.
Oh my God. Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.